Chapter 2. Intimate and Gendered Violence. The family is probably one of the most violent social institutions in the world and has been throughout history. In many societies in the past, if a wife disobeyed or displeased her husband, he had the right to discipline her. The same rule applied to parents disciplining their children. It was not until the 19th century that what is called intimate and gendered violence began to be questioned, and that legislation to protect women and children began to be introduced, requiring the intervention of the law. Most forms of intimate and gendered violence are carried out by men against women and children, or men in same-sex relationships, and can include things like domestic violence, sexual assault, and child sexual abuse, both institutional and familial. This violence is still accepted and is indeed endemic in many parts of the world today, in Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and parts of Asia, and is intimately tied to male attitudes. The exception to the rule is infanticide, where women are predominantly the perpetrators, although sometimes with the complicity of their male partners. Women can be perpetrators in other kinds of intimate violence. They can abuse their partners and their children, for example, but they are statistically always in the minority. Domestic violence. In most cultures throughout history, if a wife disobeyed her husband, it was thought right and proper that she should be corrected. There is enough research to suggest that this kind of violence was such an integral part of marriage in pre-modern Europe that there is little trace of domestic abuse in the archives. It often only comes to our attention in court records when disciplining resulted in permanent injury, miscarriage, or death. In Europe, in the ancient and medieval worlds, male heads of households were entitled, indeed, expected, to employ physical force to keep discipline among those under their control. The problem in the past was not the act of assault itself, but how to distinguish between acceptable levels of violence and excessive force. It was only in the 19th century that wife beating, along with other forms of physical violence, like street fighting, came to be viewed as unacceptable and as predominantly working-class behaviour that had to be stamped out. In one data set on Victorian England, compiled by historian Sharni de Cruz, more than one-third of those prosecuted for wife beating were categorised as skilled workmen, around half as unskilled workers, and the rest as lower middle class. It was, however, still acceptable to chastise children. When men nonetheless used excessive violence, defined as such if death or serious injury occurred, it could damage their social status. Of course, then and now, statistics on intimate interpersonal violence like domestic abuse and sexual assault are extraordinarily difficult to collate since the violence is so underreported and consequently largely hidden. Women do not want to prosecute their husbands for a whole array of reasons, consistent with women's reluctance to report sexual assault, including the way they are treated by the police and the judicial system, the low rates of conviction, and fear of further violence. Domestic abuse rates vary enormously across the world. In Australia, which is on the lower end of the scale, in the early 21st century, one woman is killed on average every 9 days, and one man every 29 days, the vast majority because of the male-on-male violence. In 2016-17, 17 people were hospitalised every day because of an assault by a partner or another family member. Very similar rates of domestic violence exist for other affluent countries and much higher rates for other parts of the world. In economically developing nations, one in three married women is battered during her lifetime by her husband. Partner-perpetrated violence, which can be anything from beatings, enforced confinement, intimidation, economic and verbal abuse, is highest in the southeastern Asian region, at around 38%, followed by the eastern Mediterranean, 37%, Africa, 36%, the Americas, 30%, Europe, 25%, Western Pacific, 24%, and high-income countries, 23%, which comprise Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Canada, members of the European Union, Israel, South Korea, and Japan. In China today, where patriarchal values persist and female submissiveness is still expected, domestic violence is largely accepted. Women do not report beatings to the police for fear of upsetting family harmony. To do so might provoke the disdain of the larger community. Patriarchal attitudes that can endanger women cut across the religious divide. In Christian communities, scripture can be used to justify domestic violence. The situation is similar in Muslim communities, where the Quran is sometimes used to justify oppressive practices towards women, a situation complicated by the intersection of religious Sharia law and the state in Muslim societies across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. As sociologist Lisa Hajjard has noted, the most important issue for understanding domestic violence and impunity in Muslim societies is the relationship between religion and the state, a relationship that can vary widely across the Muslim world. There are a number of socio-economic factors that have to be taken into account when explaining domestic violence. They include economic inequality, the predominance of patriarchal values or other forms of social inequality, social acceptance of violence in resolving domestic disputes, and the inability of women to leave violent family settings. All those things are preconditions for domestic violence, but it can only occur often if there is a degree of legal or social impunity involved in the act itself. When the perpetrator is not, for whatever reason, actively pursued and prosecuted by the law, it is often because male violence in a family setting is tolerated. This suggests a reluctance in many societies to recognize family violence as violence, or, to put it another way, family violence is considered legitimate. There is also the act itself. Although it is difficult to make generalizations, circumstances will vary from one case to the next. The violence committed by the perpetrator is about demonstrating their power over the victim. The victim is being hurt, frightened, shamed, abused. The perpetrator is communicating to the victim through an act that inflicts pain or control, that they own and dominate them. Random violence can also create a psychological dependence on the part of the abused partner. Sexual violence. Sexual assault is a global problem of immense proportions. As with domestic violence, there are no firm statistics on the number of rapes, for example. We do not know how many people are victims, nor how many people are perpetrators. We do know that sexual assault is grossly underreported. Non-reporting is particularly high among minority women, the poor and the disenfranchised sex workers and men. In Australia, around 85% of sexual assault cases are not reported. There are lots of reasons for this, from fear of not being believed to the stigma attached to being raped, from fear of revenge from the perpetrator to the embarrassment and the additional trauma associated with the police investigation and court case. Fewer than 5% of reported cases in the United Kingdom end with the rapist being convicted, a figure similar to the United States. In Australia, it's about 10%. As well, historically, there were ways of avoiding prosecution for rape. In England in the first half of the 20th century, men might plead guilty to common assault charges to escape a charge of rape. As a result, far fewer rapes appear in the historical record. In most cases, men get away with rape. In some countries, such as India, sexual assaults are tolerated to a degree because they take place behind closed doors. If there has been a shift in public understandings in some parts of the world around the acceptability of violence against women, that shift does not appear to be reflected in the statistics on sexual assault. Some of the figures are staggering. One study by the World Health Organization, data exists from 80 countries, concluded that 35% of women worldwide have experienced either physical or sexual violence in their lifetimes. That figure can vary between 23% in high-income countries to almost 38% in the Southeast Asia region. In India, a woman is raped on average every 20 minutes. In South Africa, where the magnitude of rape and gang rape has been called an unacknowledged civil war, it's every 36 seconds. There are indications, however, that while some forms of violence like homicide have remained steady in many countries over the past 200 years, indecent assaults on women have increased, and dramatically so. In England, according to historian Clive Emsley, they rose from almost 3,000 reported assaults in 1940 to 44 to over 11,000 in 1965 to 69. Similarly, in the United States, there has been an increased rate of reporting from 21,000 in 1964 to well over 100,000 in 1992. Numbers steadily declined after 1992, rising again to over 130,000 in 2016 to 2018. This may be the result of an increased awareness of assault as a social problem and an increased willingness among the police to take assault seriously, as well as broader definitions of sexual abuse and assault. It is nevertheless difficult to determine the extent to which reports have increased because of a rise in assaults or an increased preparedness on the part of victims, men and women, to report them. It's probably a bit of both. In affluent countries, at least, the taboo around discussing violent sexual and predatory behaviour in public appears to be diminishing. Regardless of the increased awareness around issues of sexual violence and sexual harassment, the Me Too movement has been a global phenomenon. Myths and stereotypes around rape persist. Historian Joanna Burke has highlighted three of those myths. The first is the belief that women lie about sexual assault. It's a myth that is deeply embedded in our society, particularly within police forces and criminal justice systems. One 2008 survey of 891 police officers in the southeastern United States found that more than 50% of officers believed that half of women who complained of rape were liars, and 10% believed that the majority of complainants were lying. A second myth is that a woman can only get pregnant if she is consenting. In other words, if a woman is raped and gets pregnant, it can't have been rape. This is an archaic view that still proponents today. In a 2012 interview, United States Senator Todd Atkin referred to some rapes as legitimate. The third myth is the idea that the victim had it coming to her. Rapists routinely state that their victims were seductive, perhaps by wearing revealing clothing, and therefore at fault. Both men and women believe this. In a recent poll in the United Kingdom, one-third of women stated that if a woman was being flirtatious, it was somehow her fault if she was raped. The reality is that men often force themselves onto women and later claim they were consenting. When someone says that an act is rape or sexual abuse, a large degree of scepticism still prevails, both in societies at large and in the legal institutions. the onus is placed on the victim to prove that they have been assaulted. This brings us to the legal definitions of rape, which can vary enormously from one period to another, from one country to another, and even within countries when there are different legal jurisdictions. The meaning of rape will thus vary greatly across socio-cultural settings. It is also a contested category that can include male-on-male sexual violence, something I won't explore here, in part because it is so under-researched, but also because for most of history, rape was defined as forceful penile penetration of the vagina in the absence of a woman's consent by a man who was not the woman's lawful husband. That is, rape within marriage, child rape, or male rape was not recognized. Rape in marriage, for example, did not become a crime until late into the 20th century. Marital rape was only recognized in Scotland in 1989 and in the rest of the United Kingdom in 1992, and is still not recognized as a crime in some 50 countries in the world today, including Bangladesh, China, India, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen, especially where dowries are involved, which implies the wife is bought and is therefore property. Despite the laws in many countries, between 10% and 26% of women experience rape in marriage, depending on the part of the world they live in. Rape in marriage law reforms in the Western world in the second half of the 20th century, brought about by women's shifting status in modern society, were not achieved without controversy. There was, and still is, in some parts of the world, opposition to the idea that it should be a criminal offence for a husband to sexually assault his wife. At its core is the idea that the state should not intervene in the family home, and especially in the marital bedroom. This is ironic, given that the same groups who opposed rape in marriage law reform, social and political conservatives, some religious groups, and even conservative women's groups often opposed legalizing homosexuality. As with domestic violence, rape thrives in situations of social and economic inequality. In her work on the history of the rapist, Joanna Bourke argues that rape is a form of social and political performance, that it is highly ritualized, and that sexual violence is deeply rooted in specific cultural, social, and political contexts. Child sexual abuse. Child sexual abuse is the involvement of a child in sexual activity, or the exploitation of a child through prostitution or pornography. As with other forms of intimate and gendered violence, knowledge about sexual violence against children in the past is limited by the state of the records and the unwillingness of parents or people in authority to report or even believe children who talked about their experiences. As a result, sexual assault against minors, much like rape, is grossly underreported. Violence against children, whatever the nature of that violence, rarely results in an arrest or conviction. Despite articles in the press in recent years around institutional abuse in the Western world, and despite a good deal of work done on the subject since the 1980s, there has been almost no historical research on child sexual abuse in many regions of the world. By the 1980s, child sexual abuse was widely recognized in most Western nations as a serious social problem. It was in part the result of media attention around various forms of abuse, including child pornography, paedophile rings, and sex murderers. There was also an increasing awareness of the rates of intrafamilial sexual assault. During the 1980s, reports of all forms of child sexual abuse in the United States swelled, in part due to widening definitions. In the United States, 22% of Americans had allegedly been victims of child sexual assault, while in Britain it was claimed that 1 in 10 children had been sexually assaulted. This led to an increase in policing, social work, and institutional resources for children, families, and caseworkers. South Africa has one of the worst records. The Tears Foundation and the Medical Research Council have stated that 50% of South Africa's children will be abused before the age of 18. Sexual activity with a minor is, by definition, violent. There are two interrelated problems that complicate the question of child sexual abuse: the age of consent and the legal definition of a minor, that is, a person who has not reached a designated stage of maturity. Such variations are linked to ideas about the onset of puberty, different expectations of childhood, shifting views about the innocence of culpability of infants and youth, and the strength of feminist and other activist movements. Historically, the age of consent has varied enormously from one part of the world to the next, and indeed still does. In England and Wales, for instance, the age of consent was raised to 12 to 13 years of age in 1875, then, scarcely 10 years later, to 16 years. There was no corresponding age of consent for boys, although it now varies in many countries from between 16 and 18 years of age. In the United States, by the end of the 19th century, the difference between the age in which a girl's yes was deemed legally to be meaningful could be as young as 10 in Mississippi and Alabama, and as high as 18 in Kansas and Wyoming. In many parts of the world today, marriage overrides the age of consent and renders sex between a husband and a child legal, regardless of the age of the child. Even in countries where a minimum age of marriage has been fixed at 18, legal loopholes can be found. According to the international not-for-profit Girls Not Brides, the Global Partnership to End Child Marriage, in Morocco, judges approve 90% of the requests they receive to let minors marry. Likewise, in Tanzania, a girl can be married at 15 with the consent of her parents. Almost 1 in 10 children in some countries in East Asia are married by the age of 15. In Bangladesh, over a quarter of girls are married before the age of 15. In Laos, for instance, 37% of children are married before they turn 18, while in the Solomon Islands, the figure is 28%. The rate is even higher in some parts of Africa. In rural areas of northern Nigeria, it is estimated that 90% of girls are married before they are 12 years old. As a result, there are at least 700 million child brides in the world who have been married before the age of 15. Broadly speaking, scholars make a distinction between three different kinds of child sexual abuse: abuse committed by a stranger, abuse committed by people in authority, known to the family, carried out with institutions whose moral responsibility is to protect children, and abuse committed within the family, intrafamilial sexual assault, commonly referred to as incest. There have been an increasing number of studies into sexual abuse of children within institutions, including schools, orphanages, and religious bodies. This kind of violence was relatively common for much of the modern era, as government inquiries held in Canada, Ireland, and the United States and Australia have demonstrated. In the case of the family, there have been significant complications with uncovering, policing, and prosecuting familial sexual violence. A great deal of secrecy surrounds violence within the family, both historically and into the present. Family sexual violence continues to remain largely hidden. As for institutional violence, organizations like the Catholic Church failed to support victims over long periods of time, while systematically protecting alleged perpetrators, including moving them to different parishes. Sex trafficking, sex tourism, and child pornography are also widespread across the globe. UNICEF have estimated that over 1 million children are trafficked annually to the West from countries in South and Southeast Asia, South and Central America, and Eastern Europe, generally to work in the sex industry. Other more conservative reports put the figure at around 600,000 to 800,000 children trafficked each year across international borders. It is estimated that around 2 million children work in the sex trade in Asia alone. The internet has become a site of child sexual exploitation in ways that never existed before the 21st century. Online trading and sharing of images and videos of children being sexually abused and tortured has increased dramatically over the last 20 years. Indeed, the problem has skyrocketed since 2014, when it was thought the number of images reached the million mark. As of 2018, tech companies identified over 45 million images and videos of children being sexually abused on the internet, some as young as 3 or 4 years of age, some even younger. Does that mean there are more paedophiles in the world, or simply that those inclined can get access to pornography material more easily? Does that mean more children are being abused and assaulted than ever before? There is evidence of growing rings of child prostitution around the world, particularly in conflict zones such as Sierra Leone, where it is estimated that some 37% of sex workers are aged under 15 years. Some regions have legislated to specifically combat sex tourism, but local enforcement agencies are often ineffectual. Infanticide. Infanticide is the killing of a baby at or shortly after birth by the mother, or at least generally with her knowledge. This too is a practice that has always existed, but as with other forms of intimate and gendered violence, it is impossible to give any accurate figures. Given the state of past medical knowledge, it was often impossible to determine for certain whether a newborn child had been born alive or dead. In recognition of the difficulties involved in determining the cause of death, authorities increasingly criminalized the concealment of the pregnancy. This was in the belief that a woman who did not publicly acknowledge her pregnancy and prepare for the child's care must have intended to kill the child. In the French city of Rennes, in 1721, after a fire had ravaged the town, 80 infant skeletons were found in the drains. The women who consigned their children's bodies to the drains of Rennes and of other cities as well were likely to have been servants or daughters living in households where they had been able to conceal their pregnancies but were unable to hide a newborn child. It is clear from testimonies given in court that neighbours, midwives, or family members did on occasion help single mothers conceal births and ensure that the newborn did not survive. This means that the convictions of infanticide or concealment of birth recorded by courts cannot be considered at all an accurate measure of the extent of the phenomenon. In other words, infanticide before the modern era went largely undetected. It appears that the sex of the baby was never a consideration, at least in Europe, and that it was generally about disposing of unwanted or illegitimate births or a means of controlling family size. In Victorian London, hundreds of small bodies were found every year, but there was neither a willingness nor the resources to pursue the crime. One estimate by historian George Belmer put the number of infanticides in England and Wales in the thousands every year, a figure that was and is never considered when calculating homicide rates. While the harsh penalties against infanticide enacted during the 16th and 17th centuries continued into the modern era in many places, in others they were eased as courts became more willing to give women the benefit of the doubt. In England by the 18th century, temporary insanity was being increasingly accepted as a plea in infanticide cases. This could still lead to a conviction, but it also held out the possibility of a pardon. There were 196 trials at the Old Bailey in London between 1690 and 1799 for infanticide. Only 62 of these returned guilty verdicts. Wider attitudes towards women began to shift in the 18th century when courts were more prepared to consider the mental state of the women in question and of murderers in general. As such, women who killed their children were often cast in the roles of victims, or they were increasingly seen to be insane. By the mid-19th century, a woman who was tried for child murder in England would escape execution and be convicted instead of a misdemeanor. If the sex of the baby doesn't appear to have been a consideration in Europe, this was not the case in other parts of the world, such as China, India, Vietnam, Pakistan, and Azerbaijan, where the pressure to produce a male child meant and still means that many female children are killed or abandoned. Let's look at two examples, India and China. It is often reported in the media that the most dangerous place in the world to be a girl is in India. Apart from the danger of rape, there are significant issues surrounding female infanticide and female foeticide, the selective abortion of girls in the womb. Although infanticide has been illegal since 1870, it continues because of extreme poverty, unwanted children conceived after rape, children with a disability, children born to impoverished families, unmarried mothers, and the dowry system. Although the state has taken steps to abolish the dowry system, the practice persists. And for poorer families in rural regions, female infanticide and gender-selective abortion are attributed to the fear of being unable to raise a suitable dowry and when being socially ostracized. Similarly, female infanticide has existed in China for centuries. As in India, the main causes were a patriarchal society, a dowry system, and poverty. As a result, infanticide was widespread, despite both Buddhist and Confucianism precepts against the practice. In 19th century China, drowning was a common method used to kill female children, as were suffocation, starvation, and exposure to the elements, despite the fact that, as historian Michelle King has pointed out, male Chinese elites considered infanticide a vulgar custom. In 1979, in a radical social experiment, the Chinese government introduced the one-child policy with the intention of keeping the population within sustainable limits. It seems to have exasperated this centuries-old tradition of a preference for sons. In a society that was already highly patriarchal, many parents believed that having a son was vital in providing for them in their old age. It is impossible to know how many girls may have been killed in this way. Many villagers had girls but simply did not register them, but some estimates are in the millions. Sexual assault in times of war. Warfare, as Joanna Bourke reminds us, is more than just about engaging in mechanical slaughter. Rape, sexual violence, sexual murder, and sexual torture in war have been committed throughout history, but it is only in recent times that scholars and the public have begun to research and discuss these topics more openly. This was the result of a number of things. The revelations in the 1990s about mass rapes and rape camps during the war in the former Yugoslavia, as well as the sexual violence during the genocide in Rwanda. The confessions about comfort women in Asia during the Second World War, and the research that has come to light about Soviet mass rapes in Eastern and Central Europe during the same war. It is possible that more rapes occurred during the Second World War than during any other war. As there is much more research on rape perpetrated in wartime against women and girls than rape committed against men and boys, I'll limit the following remarks to heterosexual assaults. Before the 1990s, rape in warfare was not all that much discussed, partly because the men and women who were victims didn't talk much about it. There are reasons for the silence. Victims can feel a sense of shame for what they have experienced, while remembering can be painful, especially when the account touches on deeply traumatic and personal events. The 16-year-old Gabrielle Kopp, for example, was one of an estimated 2 million women raped by the Red Army as it made its way across Eastern Europe near the end of the Second World War. Half of them may have been gang-raped. Kopp did not write of her harrowing experiences until the age of 80, and was only the second German woman to do so. It has been estimated that as a result of the rapes, 10,000 women in Berlin alone committed suicide. The Soviets continued to rape German women for years after the war, to the point where it became a political problem for the newly founded German Democratic Republic. Rape is carried out by individuals associated with invading armies, regardless of the side they are on, regardless of the war. German soldiers and Nazis perpetrated sexual torture and rape during the war, including against Jewish women in ghettos, in concentration camps, and in war zones. The Allies raped in France and the Philippines, in Italy and Japan during the Second World War. According to historian Bob Lilly's estimate, between 14,000 and 17,000 women were raped by American military personnel in Europe between 1942 and 1945. Thousands of Japanese women were raped in the years after the war, some of them by Australian and New Zealand soldiers, who made up the British Commonwealth Occupation Force in Japan. During the war, the Japanese army sexually enslaved tens of thousands of women who have since become known by the euphemism comfort women, a problematic term that some scholars, understandably, consider demeaning. From the late 1930s, rape and enforced prostitution were a feature of the Japanese invasion of East Asia, although there were antecedents in the Siberian intervention. Estimates of the number of women forcibly taken or tricked into sexual slavery range from between 50,000 and 200,000, mostly Korean, but also Chinese, Taiwanese, Filipino, and some Japanese women. The Japanese military, unable or unwilling to devise a less brutal system, reasoned that comfort stations would reduce rapes of local women. The Japanese army was by no means the only one guilty of forcing women into prostitution during the Second World War. So too did the German military, with estimates of up to 50,000 women and girls kept in brothels throughout the German-occupied territories. The Nazis also set up brothels inside concentration and forced labor camps, whose customers were camp prisoners, part of a perverted reward system for some of the prison population. Since the end of the Second World War, the catalogue of sexual violence in armed conflicts is significant and troubling. In 1947, the partition of Punjab between India and Pakistan led to between 75,000 and 100,000 women being kidnapped and raped. Over 9 months during the Indo-Pakistani War in 1971-72, between 200,000 and 400,000 Bengali women were raped, 80% of whom were Muslim. In the 1990s, there was widespread rape, as well as torture and killings in Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo, East Timor, Sierra Leone, and Guatemala. During the 1991-99 conflict in former Yugoslavia, mass rapes took place on all sides, but systematic and widespread violations were perpetrated by Serbian forces against Muslim, Catholic, and Croatian women. According to some estimates, approximately 20,000 women were raped. Women and girls were routinely violated in their homes, incarcerated in detention camps established explicitly for the purpose of rape, and forced into prostitution. During the Rwandan genocide of 1994, between half and 90% of surviving Tutsi girls and women were sexually assaulted, that is, anywhere between 250,000 and 500,000 women and children were raped. In the 21st century, mass rape in Darfur was an attempt to drive populations out of valuable land and into the desert. In 2011, one report estimated that in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 1,000 girls and women were raped every day. One-third of victims were children under the age of 18 years. Why rape occurs in warfare, and sometimes on a large scale, can vary from one theatre to another. In some theatres, since 1945, rape appears to have become a deliberate tactic of war. We have seen this in the Congo and the former Yugoslavia, where sexual violence became a weapon of war that communicated a powerful message as an insult to the dignity of the enemy and an act intended to humiliate the group. These examples are nevertheless rare. While men committing rape might not be driven by a desire to harm the community, they might be aware of the broader consequences of their actions. In these cases, to paraphrase Joanna Bork, the penis is a weapon. It is a tool of violence and domination. In these instances, rape becomes a ritual in which men bond through extreme violence, as with other atrocities. As has been pointed out by any number of scholars, the most important thing for men in warfare is the unit. It is these units or groups, central to the life and survival in war zones, that often commit acts of extreme violence, such as rape, murder, torture, and massacre, regardless of orders they might have been given. Where does all that leave us in terms of levels of gendered violence around the world? Gendered violence appears to be on the rise in many parts of the world. There is no one cause behind this gender violence, although outdated, patriarchal, and misogynist attitudes can help in part to explain its prevalence. Violence against women and children, both in the family and outside it, persists to this present day and is an enormous global problem. In many communities around the world, women and children are raped, trafficked, and exploited for their labour and as sex workers. The state oversees violence against women in conflict zones and sometimes systematically uses rape as a weapon of war, both in communities and in refugee camps. Approximately one-third of all women around the world have at some stage in their lives been beaten and/or coerced into sexual relations. One-quarter of all pregnant women have experienced a form of domestic violence. According to a United Nations report, at least 200 million women and girls aged between 15 and 49 have experienced genital mutilation, sometimes referred to as clitoridectomy. There are still countries such as Tanzania, Togo, Iraq, Kenya, and Ghana where female genital mutilation is almost universal. It is thought that around 5,000 women are killed around the world each year in so-called honor killings. All these measures are put in place to control female sexuality and female reproduction. Women are harassed and assaulted in the workplace at levels that are generally hidden from view and therefore carried out with impunity. I have only just touched the surface of the abuse women have to endure. Attitudes have shifted in some parts of the world but have gone nowhere near as far as they should, while they have barely shifted in many other parts of the globe. For the present, women are disproportionately the victims of sexual and domestic abuse in most societies around the world. The widespread evidence of sexual abuse both in peace and in wartime, points to the disconcerting widespread acceptance of rape that appears to be a factor in the very low rates of prosecution and conviction around the world.